The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
This woman walks a lot.
Yes.
Why does she walk?
She walks because that's her schedule, you know, so it's kind of like, this is when I walk. And it's a way for her to create a coherent world. She's also, though, kind of on a little treasure hunt all the time. So she's both looking at details of the world, collecting little freebies along the way, like the free perfume at the Macy's counter. She's out there foraging and scavenging, doing a kind of off-kilter flaneuring, or whatever that French word is, of collecting things with your eyes. But she's kind of also driven, I think, to walk, and so she can't not.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast devoted to authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Megan McNamer about her novel Children and Lunatics, which recently won the Black Lawrence Press Big Moose Prize.
Why is every third house important to her?
Well, I think it's partly she loves that feeling of chance and kind of the tossing of the dice and see what will happen. And so there is very much, I think, in her heart and soul, this feeling of being on this sort of tremulous edge. And she isn't quite sure what she is either anticipating or dreading. But I think, you know, every day her walks are kind of a quest. And she is looking for something. And one of the things I think she is looking for is home, an actual home that's not her silent rooms. And so she's fantasizing about those. And so the every third house is, I think, is partly to keep herself entertained and keep herself moving forward. And it makes her scrutinize different houses every day because she takes different routes, or she starts counting at a different time maybe. And she thinks up kind of stories in her mind about who might live there.
There are quite a few scenes where she's either counting or she has some kind of a rhythm going on.
Yeah.
And that seems to come from some way for her to feel safe, or like things are happening the way they're supposed to.
Right. I think some of that counting is a little bit of a panic attack response without panic attack training. You know, that she's just intuitively trying to calm herself down. But I think it's also part of the game. She's kind of stuck, I think, in her childhood with her little brother, Eddie. And I think they played these sorts of games of watching the train cars go by, counting, and kind of a way of keeping the world in place and affixing themselves to it. I think that's her version of sanity.
Mm. As you said, she's created these schedules for herself.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing on her schedule is First Wednesday.
Yeah.
So what happens on First Wednesday?
Well, you go to the restaurant downtown, and the restaurant gives cut rates on a very simple lunch, and then they give the rest to a charity. And so people are urged to patronize that restaurant on First Wednesday, knowing that it will go to some good. She's patronizing it, though, because the lunch is cheaper. And she probably discovered that, and then it became part of her rigid pattern. So she has to go on First Wednesday, and she has to sit at that table.
Well, let's hear about one of those Wednesdays.
Okay. There were three possible waitresses on Wednesday, and this particular waitress was her favorite. She had glossy bangs and a low, liquid voice. She spoke little, and her tone was quiet, but it was easy to imagine her singing. She did not say, "Well, how are we today?" as if she were a nurse. She did not say, "Here you go," when bringing the bread, as if she were a volunteer at Christmas time bringing a toy. She did not say, "Okay," when she took the order in the first place, as if the ordering and delivery of soup and salad were an exciting adventure, an arduous task finally agreed upon, a great collaboration. She simply raised her eyebrows, with no indication of any memory of any other Wednesday, and said, "Ready to order," in her calm, quiet voice, and nodded in a serious way as she wrote. She had beautiful hands. The fingers were long and thin and pale, with blue veins. She wore no rings. Her nails were trimmed closely and polished with a clear shine. She had a writer's bump on the third finger of her right hand, the hand that held the pen for taking orders. She had hair to her chin, thick and chestnut brown. Occasionally, she flicked at her hair with her writing hand, the pen barely missing her eyes, which were large, clear, and violet. "Tell Audrey," she heard the cook say to the cashier on a frosty October Wednesday, a day well suited to wearing one of the cold season woolen berets and pleasurable for walking. She had brought a satchel with acrylic gloves inside, in case the sun didn't quite burn off the chill. But she wanted to keep the gloves off for now, thinking to sample the hand lotion at Macy's. "Audrey," the cashier called across the room, and this waitress looked up from her pad, her eyebrows raised to indicate she had heard. "No more pasta." She herself already had her pasta salad, maybe the last of the lot. She was nearly finished with it, in fact, bite number 9. It tasted very good. Audrey. Something about that name. A name from childhood. Audrey, the good little witch. Smooth hair, a magic wand, smiling, shadowless, normal. Always a happy ending. Audrey. Audrey Alu. That's what Eddie would say.
And who is Eddie?
Eddie is her little brother.
She thinks a lot about him.
Yeah, he kind of accompanies her on her sojourns, I think, in her mind.
And I got the idea that he must have died young,
yes.
Tragically.
Yes, he did. So Eddie's gone, but she's kind of carrying him around in her mind.
And this might explain some of why she is the way she is.
Yes, that's what I thought.
That was just kind of an undercurrent in the story.
Yeah, a great missingness of Eddie.
Why doesn't this woman have a name?
It just didn't really seem necessary, I guess. I kind of got into the writing of this in her head, and although it's not first person, obviously, but I didn't really know her name, and it never presented itself somehow. Mary Jane Nealon wrote a nice blurb for this book, and she sent me an email, and she said, "Am I right or wrong? I mean, there's no name, and the other woman has no name, these two women." And I went, "You know, you're right." I didn't think about it that much. I didn't purposefully, let's have them be no-name people. I could imagine what their names might be. It just was kind of inconsequential, I guess.
Well, I think in her case, having no name really adds to her anonymity in the world in a strong way. Like, she's this woman who goes out walking and who has these quirky habits, but she doesn't really have a place in the world. And if she weren't here tomorrow, nobody would notice.
So, exactly. That's, yeah. It was like if suddenly she became Patsy or Barbara or, you know, Diane, it's like, then you really, I would anyway, want to know much more of her history and her her record, her public record.
Yeah. Why did she have that particular name or something?
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that a certain house changes the trajectory of this woman's life. And I'd like you to read the passage in which she finds that house.
Okay. It happened on a bus day. Occasionally, she gave herself a bus day when she would get on a smart bus at the downtown terminal, whichever bus was first to arrive, no matter the number or destination, and just ride. She tried not to look at the number because she generally knew which numbers went where. She tried to make it a surprise. The number 5 was her favorite. Only a few times in her experience had it not been first to arrive. It went up Butler Creek Crossing, winding its way in a leisurely fashion through all the modern houses after the initial fast sail up Butler Creek Drive. The number 5 on a weekday was as empty as the streets. The driver knew her, but she pretended not to know him, so he pretended not to know her. She knew he knew her because he had tried to strike up a conversation once or twice when it was just the two of them. He had commented on her hat. After that, she sat farther back and kept her gaze out the window. She picked a number. She found it in the free news weekly. At the bus terminal, she would pick up a paper and leaf through it until she found the number. 3 school board vacancies to be filled. No, it had to be larger than 5. 10 ways to make Halloween spooktacular. No, not larger than enough. U.S. military death toll approaching 2,000. No, it had to be less than 100. 55 alive. Driving class directed at seniors. Okay. After the bus passed Butler School, she counted to the number at an even tempo, not so slow as 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi. She used Alu instead, the suffix her little brother Eddie would hang on numbers, names, and some nouns. Mama Alu, he said, at age 3. Sissy Alu, he said, Santa Alu, and Bunny Alu, and Pinocchio Alu. He said, I am 4 Alu, 5 Alu. It was his way of affixing things to the world, keeping them in place. God Alu, he even said that. At Halloween, Eddie put on the hard plastic battered Casper the Ghost mask, his breath rasping through the cracks and nose hole, his face like a moon. Casper Alu, he said with a muffled, buried voice, cocking his stiff smile this way and that. When she reached the given number, 55 Alu, she pulled the bell, gathered up her satchel, and prepared to get off. The bus glided to a wholly unexpected spot, and she descended, the driver watching her. The bus left with a hiss, the driver's eyes turned back to the road. The quiet, curving street was lined with smooth lawns and sporadic sidewalks. She began to walk, purposefully, head up, satchel tucked under her arm. Eyes open and fixed, she began again to count. She counted to half the previous number, rounding to the next highest, 28 Alu. And when she reached that number, she stopped and looked at the house, her house, the house that might be home. One day it was a 2-story house with a sun porch. Another time it was a white painted brick house with a columned front porch and a stone bench. Each time just looking had the feel of going, going in. She heard an imaginary bell, a signal. Cross the line, careful, proceed, step through. There were high cirrus clouds on this particular day, long wisps against the palest blue, a faint breeze, a hint of smoke still lingering from the forest fires of the summer. It was on the cusp, the sky, the air, the day. It was on a fulcrum, balanced between all that had happened and what was yet to come. After acknowledging her house, 2-story stucco, shaded, with half a fence out front and lumber tossed here and there on the lawn, as if more building were in progress. She walked up the angled sidewalk that led to the front door under an archway flanked by bushes. The porch was made from stones. A small brass dog stood next to a bristled mat. A collar hung around the dog's neck. It said, Attack Dachshund. The bell made a chiming sound when she pushed it, and a delayed summons emitted from deep within. She listened to the chime and to a plane that droned in the sky, far overhead, and to a distant call of a train. She could feel her heart beating. It made her entire body move, slightly, like a tree stirred by a breeze. She pressed the black button again and heard the chime a second later, and she waited. The jet's monotone receded into silence. The train remained, its presence a rhythmic thrum. Brown flowers in a pot moved just perceptibly in the late autumn air. She turned the knob and gently pushed. The door swung open and let her in.
You've been listening to Megan McNamer read from her novel Children and Lunatics. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. We'll talk about the passage you just heard and find out more about Megan's characters and process of writing after a short break. You can listen again or share this conversation with a friend from our blog, which you'll find online at mtpr.org/twq. Links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages are also there. Our podcast recently migrated to another location in cyberspace, so if your podcast feed goes missing, please reconnect with us at mtpr.org.
So that whole scene, basically, it's a string of very small happenings and nothing extraordinary, and yet it adds up to something that's emotionally moving and makes us think that something's about to happen. She opens the door. Mm-hmm. Is that something you think about when you're putting those sentences together?
I don't know.
You don't play a movie in your mind of this woman
really.
Doing this?
Not really. And, you know, it was kind of interesting process for me, if you want to call it process. But I kind of knew my weaknesses as a writer, which were I'm really happy to just stay on the bus and to watch things go by and to have her notice oddities. But I knew that I might be happy to hang out with that woman, you know, indefinitely, but it was kind of asking a lot for anyone else to go along. And it wasn't really a question of better or worse. It was just, I want something to happen. And I, you know, you kind of maybe try to write what you love to read. And I love that small shifts of drama. So not great big, someone leaps into the living room and slashes the entire household to death. But a really subtle, dramatic move. And so, you know, that pleased me when I made that happen. But I didn't kind of plot out, okay, I think I'm going to have her go into one of these houses. She just did. And it sounds kind of precious to say that, oh, it just happened. But in this case, it just did. And then I was kind of left with, now I got to go in too, and let's see what happens. So that was quite a eye-opener to me. I didn't think of the writing process as really having that element to it. And of course, you probably don't want that all the time, but in this particular little scene, that's how it played out.
Well, I thought that was what was particularly extraordinary about the book, that you were able to create tension with just ordinary things happening. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, I guess I just get tired of the overwrought drama that happens in some novels. Not that I want to read quiet scenes all the way through the novel, and there's plenty that happens here that is unexpected and isn't quiet. But I just thought it was refreshing to read something that was built from small pieces and then eventually opened up into something much larger. Do you remember when this woman first occurred to you?
It's kind of odd because I did just begin with the first line and then saw what happened after it. And I actually was doing a lot of walking during the period of writing this book. I guess I was kind of writing it in my head. And I was doing a lot of not so compulsive, but kind of compulsive walking. And people kept commenting on it. You know, and then I thought, why don't I live in a city? But and right. People would always say, I saw you walking. And what do you say to that? Yes. Okay. But it was kind of like I had to tell them why, or not really account for it, but it was just noticeable. And it was always a friendly comment, of course. But it made me just start thinking about that. And I think to just get myself launched, I put that sentence down.
And the first sentence is, she was beginning to be known.
She was beginning to be known.
And then there are a few sentences about people noticing her. I saw you walking.
Yeah, I saw you walking. For some reason, I always think the first sentence is, I saw you walking. It doesn't matter, but it's just kind of odd that I can't remember the first sentence of my book. But anyway, it was kind of just a tactic to get going, you know, get moving. And then I kept walking and I kept jotting down these things that were burbling up having to do with that woman walking. And that's about as close as I came to a game plan. And it did end up, I feel, being about a big thing, but I didn't start out with that intention.
Where did the title come from?
It's from that quote by Cocteau, children and lunatics cut the Gordian knot that the poet spends his life trying to untie. And I've puzzled that over, actually, a lot, thinking, is that a good thing? But I hear it as that lunatics, if you think of lunatics in the good sense here, of people who are off the mental grid, and children, you know, can really cut to the chase in terms of seeing something. Seeing it clearly or feeling it deeply. And, you know, I don't want to diss poets or writers or artists, but that is the same impulse, I guess. And it's just that art takes a long time, and it takes a lot of overtly sane-looking activity surrounding it to make it. Whereas possibly, at least Cocteau is saying, that children and lunatics kind of have possessed that all along. And so an artist is trying to get back there in a way, maybe.
Your bio states that you earned an MA in something called ethnomusicology. What is that?
What? You don't have a degree in that?
I do not.
It's a fabulous discipline. And I think I'm one of two ethnomusicologists in Missoula. The other is Dorothy Morrison. And there are different terms for, like, anthropology of music or a certain way of musicology where you are really trying to get past history and structure of sound to identity and how music is so deeply human-made and how that's this point. And people argue forever at all these conferences and panels about what ethnomusicology is, and I'm away from it now for a good many years. But that was my training. That was what I was totally passionate about 30 years ago. And that's just all I wanted to think about or do. So that's kind of funny.
What did you do as an ethnomusicologist?
Well, you know, you got to go to graduate school, so that's fabulous. And what you would do in kind of the old school world is, you know, it's like being an anthropologist. You go out into communities and you look around and you notice very deeply and you wonder about things and you wonder if there's an order to them and you wonder what they mean to the people who are up to them. So, you know, it's very, very much like being a writer. And it's perfect training to study ethnomusicology to segue eventually into writing, mainly writing fiction, possibly. One of my big heroes back then was Clifford Geertz, and he would call ethnographies fiction in the very literal sense, and that they are something fashioned by one human's mind, influenced by myriad other minds, impinging on something out there, but it's a construction and as vivid as and true as you can make it. So to me, it seems very closely linked, and I think it's a great pursuit, ethnomusicology.
Well, I can certainly understand its influence on this book now that I've heard you describe it.
Yeah.
What else do you want to say about this book or this story?
Well, it's kind of not funny, but odd funny in that a lot of this sort of came out of me in a kind of quiet rage, I guess you would say, about Iraq and the post 9/11 world. And I didn't really realize it at the time. I thought it was about a bag lady and a kid and stuff like that. But I know that that was the governing emotion behind this.
Yes, the family that lives in the house is affected by the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're kind of dingbats, the parents. And, you know, I just think we all feel like kind of dingbats in the face of large fears and feel pretty ineffectual. But, boy, I did not want this to be like a polemic or a political novel.
Oh, no, it wasn't at all.
Good. No. I had a few quotes in there from some military recruitment brochures, and they were actually real brochures. And I did go through this kind of obsessed stage of trying to do stuff in the schools to get them out of the schools.
The recruiters.
Well, yeah, well, it was shocking to see the, you know, I had two sons who were in high school, and they were really just thinking about Friday night or skateboarding at the skate park after school or whatever, and to have their minds be presented with brochures that said things like, ever hear that little voice in your head that says, get a life? It just got louder. And to really realize how absolutely vulnerable they were to that. And I was just on a kind of a quiet rampage to try to do something about that. And then time passed. Those brochures went into a box, and they're somewhere in my house. I have no idea where. But anyway, my editor wanted to cite them, you know, in the acknowledgments. And I told her I would try to find them, and I tried to Google around and find them. But I couldn't find them, the exact ones. And then I just thought, I don't want at the get-go, you know, to have something so real in the world be flagged. So there were a lot of National Geographic titles in this book, and we changed it to Globe and Cosmos, which I think would be kind of a cool magazine.
It would. I want to read that.
Yeah. Little fashion, little particle physics thrown in.
Perfect.
Megan McNamer lives in Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about her at mtpr.org/twq. Also there you'll find poems and children's book reviews, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. And just to be sure you don't miss any of these conversations, sign up for our podcast at mtpr.org. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.